The essential conversation around race and racism in this country has long engaged some of the most insightful and morally oriented thinkers that we have. But it's undeniable that now, at long last, more people are finally listening. And so it is heartening that we are seeing a powerful new book, White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America, emerge at a time such as this. The author is Dr. Anthea Butler, who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and has given us several other important and timely books. Anthea, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've been thinking and writing on these issues for such a long time. Why was it that now was the right time for this book?
I think now is the right time because we were at a moment in the nation where the kinds of racial problems and murders and things that were happening had just come to a head. And we haven't really talked about evangelicals' roles in all of that. And so I thought that while everybody was wringing their hands about, well, why are evangelicals involved with Donald Trump? Why are they voting with him? Why are they doing all these things? I thought that it would be helpful to look at a history that points exactly to where we are today and the reasons why they have been supportive of these kinds of racial policies.
You've been clear, and you don't pull any punches in drawing that bright line from conservative evangelical politicking to racism. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important about the book is what I'm trying to do is show people that the kinds of moral issues that evangelicals have been engaged in, whether they're talking about the family, whether they're talking about the ways in which education should be done, whether they're talking about abortion, these all have racial foundations to them. And a lot of them begin in the 19th century surrounding slavery. And so I thought what would be important for people to see is to see the genesis of that, first of all, to see the ways in which this policy has been deployed throughout history. And then third, to sort of disabuse people of the notion that evangelicals themselves aren't political. They are very political. And they are very political in the ways in which they think about race, racism, morality, and other issues, and how all of these things come together to both protect them, but to also promulgate the policies that they want to see happen in America.
So help our listeners by taking a look back into American history and telling us a little bit about where the origins of this are that you've identified.
Well, I basically start the book in the 19th century to talk about slavery. And while evangelicals have sort of told a story about themselves that they were abolitionists, I talk about the evangelicals who were actually slaveholders and used the Bible to support slavery. And I think that that is an important moment to begin to even understand where we are denominationally in terms of Baptists who split apart, Southern Baptists, American Baptists, Methodists that split apart, Presbyterians that split apart over the issue of slavery, and that we had people who were religious that were slaveholders. I think, you know, it's very hard for people to understand that somebody like George Whitefield owned slaves and used that money to support his missionary activities. That is shocking for some people to find out, but I think it's important to know that and to also see the ways and the manner in which this gets deployed throughout history. If we go past the Civil War into Reconstruction and redemption, we can start to see where the religion of the lost cause that Charles Reagan Wilson talked about became an important latch point for racism, especially in the South and in the North as well. We think about the ways in which scripture was used to justify Jim Crow, to keep African Americans from voting, to do all sorts of things that were harmful to the newly freed community of African Americans in this country, and to deny them the rights that were rightfully theirs. We moved this up into the Civil Rights Movement to begin to see how people like Billy Graham really weren't the, you know, progressives that we might have said that they were, and to the Moral Majority, to Christian Coalition, and to, you know, who I basically call the evangelical president, George W. Bush, who was also, you know, at a president at a time of deep Islamophobia and ushered in a time of really of big racism for evangelicals with the election of Barack Obama. So all of these things, I think, are important in seeing how this arc of history from slavery forward has inflected and infused and supported the kinds of things that evangelicals believed in and also wanted to influence on society.
We do a lot of talking these days about unconscious bias. Would you call this trend something that is unconscious, or was it a deliberate manufacturing of a language of morality and values to justify a more sinister racist agenda?
I think for leaders, it was deliberate. I think that for people, it may be unconscious, but these things have been so much part of parlance that you might think of them as unconscious. But I think actually, you know, I'll be clear that I think part of this is about the ways in which evangelicals have written their history. They have been very careful to write a history of valor, of moral suasion, of all these kinds of things. And I think, you know, we have to start with historians and call them to account about the kinds of histories that they've written about evangelicalism, first of all. And then secondarily, how their, you know, ignorance or ignoring of race has caused us to think that evangelicals perhaps aren't racist, but in fact, they really are. And that's a problem.
We've sort of alluded to this, but will you differentiate between leaders who are benefiting from this very purposeful racism and their followers who may be less aware of the role that race plays in their community?
I think that people get led by their leaders and they have unconscious bias, but they also have ways in which they profit from that unconscious bias. So in other words, if we're talking about, let's say, and I'm going to use them because I think I pick on them a lot in the book because it's easy to, the Southern Baptists. I mean, if you're sitting in a Southern Baptist congregation, you benefit from the racism that happens because your leaders basically say that, oh, we've repented of this, so we have moved on and it's done. And that's without a clear conscious look at the ways in which the denomination has been built up. So for instance, right now, where you have Black Southern Baptist pastors leaving the denomination because of all this talk about critical race theory, when you've had six white Southern Baptist presidents say they don't want to think about critical race theory, well, they could simply just begin to think about their history and think about how their history has been racist and how, despite the fact that they've had numerous racial reconciliation efforts, these racial reconciliation efforts don't manage to keep anybody Black in the denomination because they continue to be racist.
You know, your insight on this is critical because there are conversations that have to happen inside the communities that you're describing. But before they can happen, we have to take into account that even mentioning racism in majority white faith communities triggers a kind of defensiveness that shuts down the hope of any honest look at the situation. What do we do about that?
Well, I think that first of all, what people can do is read this book, because I think it's a good way to see the history that a lot of people don't know. That's first of all. Second, it's a history that is coming from somebody who's not writing from the outside, but used to be an insider. I went to an evangelical seminary. I went to Fuller Seminary. I know how evangelicals think. I've been trained by evangelicals. I respect the movement, but I also have been hurt by the movement. And this isn't a book not about that hurt, but about the kinds of ways that we all get hurt by racism. And I think that these denominations need to understand that the kinds of things that they have done wittingly or unwittingly have caused them to be put into this kind of a space. And I think it's worth mentioning here, especially that because I didn't start this book off by dealing with the question that everybody seems to have, which is, why did evangelicals vote for Donald Trump? Why are they so much for Donald Trump? That takes us out of that, you know, charged environment to say, look at this history, and then you will understand why 2016 happened.
So I want to ask you about Fuller Seminary for just a minute. You were there. You were a member of the denominations that are served by Fuller Seminary. Were you conscious of this racism when you were within the community, or were you only able to see it when you stepped outside?
I was conscious of it in the community. And I think the reason why is, I'll be honest, the book is dedicated to two of my mentors that I met at Fuller, one who is deceased, Walter Hollenweger, and the other, Bill Pinnell, who's a very famous Black evangelical, who wrote about the racism in evangelicalism in the 1960s. And, you know, conversations with him, conversations with professors who were open, things that happened on campus. I came to Fuller right after the Los Angeles uprising or riots, depending on how you want to talk about that, in 1992. So it was a charged time that I entered into seminary. And it was a time in which we were all talking about race because we had to be. We had to be because of what had happened in Los Angeles. And so while Fuller, on the one hand, has been a very progressive evangelical seminary, it has benefited from these kinds of stories that have been told about it by people like George Marsden. And I don't pick on Marsden. I think he's a great, you know, scholar. But I also think that he was a scholar who was blind to race and didn't want to write about that because that was not a concern for him.
So I'd like to get into the ways that you say institutionalized racism benefits conservative evangelical churches that you focus on in the book. Name some of those benefits.
Well, I think the first benefit that it does is it makes it a lot easier for you to meet politicians. So in other words, the ways in which we have lobbying organizations, most people don't understand that Focus on Family, American Family Association, Family Research Council, these are not just organizations that raise money and funds to fight back abortion and to think about schools and everything. They are lobbying organizations. And so they're from the very beginning, they have inroads into Washington, D.C. and other places to promulgate their policies and things that they want to have happen. And so that's really great. Why do we think about Christian schools? This whole story I tell in the book about Bob Jones University and the tax exemption when they, you know, the taking away of their tax exemption when they had to, integrate and they don't want to integrate. We had Christian schools because people didn't want to go to school with Black people. And so you have these, you know, segregation academies that rise up, that a lot of them are Christian schools. We have to think about this in terms of employment. You can, you know, discriminate if you are a Christian school. You don't have to hire somebody who's, you know, gay. You don't have to think about certain kinds of people if they don't fit your parameters. There are ways in which this has permeated our entire governmental structure and the structure of institutions and churches. And so I think it's really important for us to start to think about the ways in which Christians, especially evangelicals, have benefited from that and have been able to carve out these walls around themselves that allow them to be racist, but to claim that they aren't racist because they're not, you know, physically racist, like wearing sheets or something like that.
A lot of institutions and a lot of politicians will look back even 10, 20, 25 years and say things are different now. How do current political leaders benefit from this same kind of systemic racism that you've discussed?
Well, they benefit in lots of different ways, the ways in which their worlds are circumscribed. They benefited by that, by this kinds of structural racism, even in voting and all of these things that I think about, you know, how we talk about gerrymandering and other things. They benefit because people have been there to set up the structures. So if I'm thinking about evangelicals in the way, for instance, that they took over school boards and all this stuff, by the time we get to somebody who's in the Trump administration, who basically rolls back Title IX rules because, you know, basically you don't have to pay attention to the sexuality stuff. Why would we do that? You know, why would Secretary DeVos have to do anything with that? That's part of her evangelical belief. That, you know, perhaps maybe it's women's fault. Maybe we shouldn't think about things like that. Or maybe this is too unseemly and should be dealt with in a different way. We shouldn't hold people responsible for that. And so that's how these ideas get permeated and come into a governmental system, because we have people who wanted to dismantle that structure. If you want a great example of how this has happened, look at the educational system in this country. Look at the ways in which high schools and junior high schools and other things have been gutted by this, we don't want government to be in the middle of the education system and let's set up charter schools. This was another way to gut the education system and to bring those kinds of racial ideas into the mix, where you don't want to have people mixing. You don't want integration. You don't want those kinds of things. And you can say that ostensibly because it's like, well, I don't want my Christian children to have to deal that way. Same thing with homeschooling. I think if we look at education, someone could have written this book simply about education in America alone and how evangelicals' intervention in education shows the racist structures that they have created and continue to create in order to keep others out.
You know, I've noticed that simply noting that there are disparities and injustices doesn't always prompt people to reflection and change. But are there some communities that are moving away from this kind of power dynamic? And if so, what's motivating them?
Well, I think younger communities of evangelicals are, and I think what's motivating them in part is seeing the, you know, the continual loop of violence against African Americans and others in this country. We just, you know, we're taping this after a huge murder of eight people in Atlanta, including six Asian women. And this kind of AAPI, you know, racism that's happening right now comes directly from historic ideas about, you know, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in missionary accounts from the 19th century and the ways people get sexualized. I mean, I don't even have to make it a black-white thing. I can go down the list of different groups in America who have been, you know, racialized in certain kinds of ways by Christian groups, ostensibly through, you know, spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ, right? And so I think what we have to really begin to see now is how this is part and parcel of our culture, how this has been weaponized in the last 4 years, especially during the Trump administration. And how are we going to begin to dismantle this so that we can have a more just and fair society?
Beyond some of these individual communities that you've identified and discussed, you write in the book that American evangelicalism writ large needs a reckoning, and it needs it now. What does that reckoning look like?
Well, I actually think the reckoning looks like what I'm trying to do in the book, which is hold the mirror up to them to show them that it's not as beautiful as they think. They're not as beautiful as they think they are. That's the first thing, is to realize that, yes, indeed, despite the fact that you love Jesus very much, you can be racist. And that coming to that grips to that with that is an important factor. That's number one. Number two is to realize why people are walking out of their churches and denominations. I mean, I think the Southern Baptists are a great example, but Methodists and others are all having the same kind of issue, right? And so whether it's about sexuality, whether it's about race, whether it's about young people who don't care about the same things that they cared about anymore, that evangelicals care about anymore, I think it's important for them to see that because of their stances, and especially in the last 4 years, that they've become pariahs. And that not only are they pariahs, but they're pariahs that are responsible for a lot of different things. So let me take one example that's a pretty current one. When Please. We talk about coronavirus, right, and all the churches that wanted to meet and meet unmasked, despite everything, despite science, and not caring. I get why you want to go to church, but there are reasons why for public health that you shouldn't. And people fought tooth and nail against this, saying that this was religious freedom. Well, it's not just about religious freedom for you. It's about protection for the communities. And, you know, what all of this did was make very clear that as far as things go, anything outside of the confines of evangelicalism, they do not care about.
Now, having said all of this, I'm hoping that you have some hope for the future, that there will be more than cosmetic change, that there will be systematic change. Is there something that gives you that hope?
Yeah, younger people, I think. I think that the changes in which how people are talking about their Christianity gives me hope. That's first thing. I think, you know, to quote scripture here, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, therefore it can bring much fruit. I need some of this stuff to die. That's to be honest with you. And I think that it's dying in part because people are realizing that it's not bringing life to them. I think that, you know, even though it's been really hard to watch, you know, the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others, and how some evangelicals have spoken about Black Lives Matter, I think that these social movements are a way in which to call evangelicals to account for their unchristlike behavior towards people because they believe that they have the truth and nobody else has it. I think what gives me hope also is the fact that, you know, this may sound very strange, is that people are leaving. And in the leaving, I have hope because there's a chance to create different kinds of structures and more just structures for people that, you know, encompass in Christianity in one sense. And in another way, to think about the kinds of damage that Christianity has done through racism and the use of racism and the cross as a way to put people in strange places. I think that what I'm most hopeful about, and the thing that I'm most hopeful about, is that people who have been oppressed by this, whether they're African-American, Asian-American, Latinos, and other ethnic groups, are starting to realize the pain that being in these kinds of groups has caused them, and they are confronting that in different and various ways.
You are able to bring this message because of your experience as an evangelical and because you had the training at Fuller Seminary that exposed you to the full range of this. You're speaking, though, to white people as an outspoken Black woman.
Yes, I am.
Are there white leaders within the evangelical community that you look to? I'm not asking you to name anybody, but are there white leaders that you're leading to, that you're looking to be the voice of this kind of necessary transformation?
No. I want to say that very clearly. No, I think, you know, and when I say no, I mean, I'm not looking at white male leaders that way. I mean, honestly, to be quite frank with you, I'm more intrigued with women like Beth Moore, because I think that's a much more powerful place to move from. And she's just left the Southern Baptist. And although she and I would not agree on everything, I think her confrontation of the Southern Baptist men is a good start, because I think that, you know, how we reach people with people who are real. I don't know that denominational leaders are going to pay much attention to this. I'll be honest with you. I mean, they may say that they think I'm in critical race theory or something like that, but I don't, I mean, I got to be honest with you. I don't look to leaders. And I want to be really clear here also, as well, is that, yes, of course, there are some names that you would think that I would say right off the bat. I don't think this is going to come from the leadership we have right now. I'm not sure that they're capable. I think it's going to come from younger people and people who are willing to look at what is in this book, willing to think about change, and willing to do that on a grassroots level. I don't look at leaders as a way to make change anymore. There's change that could come from the bottom up, and I think that's the place where it needs to come from.
Wow. That's an important message for people to hear, because too often people who are in positions of power will do just enough to keep themselves in power.
Exactly. And I think we've seen from all of this, as I've shown in the book, that these, you know, reconciliations and all this stuff, this is dressing. I need people to do the real work, and real people do real work. Leaders want to think about how they remain in power.
So let's talk about that real work for my last question here. What is it you would like every reader of this book to take away with them after they've read it? And they should.
To think about the ways in which, whether they're Christian or not, that they've bought into the stories they've been told about evangelicalism and how that has affected their behavior towards others. So in other words, what I mean by that is how has it been that your acceptance of, you know, all the things that you've been told about law enforcement, all the things that you've been told about prison, all the things you've been told about abortion, all the things you've been told about, you know, segregation, or that civil rights, where now we're all equal, all of those things that you've been told, you need to start to rethink them, because this history makes you have to rethink the history of evangelicalism. And, you know, there can be multiple tracks. There can be multiple ways to think about things. There can be nuance. And I think that for a lot of evangelicals, they've taken this, you know, happy story about themselves and thought that that was the only story that there was. But this is another story. And that story should cause them grief, and it should cause them pause, and it should cause reflection, but it should also cause action.
Dr. Anthea Butler is Associate Professor of Religious Studies and the Graduate Chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her previous books include Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World. Dr. Butler's latest book is White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America, due out March 22nd, 2021, from the University of North Carolina Press. Anthea, thank you so much for what you bring to this essential conversation, and for taking this time to be with us on State of Belief.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.